Hello and welcome to the show on what's a milestone moment for the podcast. I've started recording video. Now, if you want to check us all out in glorious Technicolor, do head over to the YouTube channel, which is linked in the show notes, and subscribe, like, hit the notification button and all that other good stuff that the proper YouTubers tell you to do. I'll be trying to do more video content and get over my fear of my own stupid face, but never fear. I'm still here with you in your ears on all the podcast platforms if you need me. But whilst I've got you here, I'm also going to ask you if you can spend a couple of minutes filling in a questionnaire. I'm looking to set up a course with my co-conspirator and former podcast guest Saeed Khan, where we aim to tackle one of the trickiest relationships in B2B product management, the relationship between product management and sales. If you head over to onenightinproduct.com/sales, you can fill in our course survey, help shape the course, and we'll even give you a tasty discount if you decide to come with us on the journey when it's out. That's onenightinproduct.com/sales. On tonight's episode, we speak all about product operations. What are the three pillars of product operations? When's the right time to start thinking about implementing it? Why are so many people suspicious about product ops? And is process really a dirty word? For answers to all these questions and much more, please join us on One Night in Product. So tonight, my two guests are Melissa Perry and Denise Tillis. Eagle-eared listeners will remember Melissa coming on a show a couple of years ago to talk about executive product leadership, escaping the build trap at work, as well as the other type of build trap due to her incredible DIY skills. She also mentioned a new book she was writing with someone called Denise. Well, Denise is that someone called Denise, a former journalist who once interviewed Mick Jagger back when he was only 100 years old, and an experienced product leader, consultant, and advocate for product operations. They're both here tonight to talk about their recent book, unsurprisingly called Product Operations, How Successful Companies Build Better Products at Scale. Hi, Denise. Hi, Melissa. How are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
Very good.
I am doing wonderfully well and really excited to start digging into some important and hopefully not too controversial subjects. But, you know, we can bring the controversy if we need to. But first things first, we've set the scene. We've named the book. It's been out for a little while now. I think it came out towards the end of last year. So how's the reception been for the book so far? And what kind of feedback have you been getting from the masses?
Yeah, so far reception has been really good. We are getting a lot of people reaching out saying that they had been doing product operations for a very long time, but they had never had a defined role for it or had a name for it before. We've heard a lot of product leaders saying that's helped them figure out what they were missing in their organization to actually get some help and help scale. But generally, extremely positive feedback.
You know, it was interesting for me. I was chatting with someone at Morgan Stanley, and it was kind of the highest compliment. She said, "I felt like you guys were sitting behind me at my desk."
And it sort of captured,
it captured all of the pain points that she had experienced. So that felt like high praise.
Well, it's always good to get validation for your work and obviously also racking up some positive reviews on Amazon as well. So it seems like you've definitely got some fans. But Melissa, last time we spoke on the podcast, you talked a little bit about the trauma of writing your first book, Escape the Build Trap, and how you just about had enough time to heal after that to then start considering writing a new one, obviously writing that with Denise as well. So how was the writing process this time? Was it as traumatic as writing one on your own? Was it harder? Was it easier? Like, how did that go for you?
Oh, it was a lot easier. I'd say less traumatic.
Is that because Denise did all the work?
No, we split the work pretty evenly, but it was a huge, I mean, having somebody else, you know, to actually bounce ideas off of is huge. So there'd be like parts of these, you know, books that we get to a chapter and I'd be like, you know, I've done this 18,000 times, but I'm having a really hard time explaining it. And then Denise would be like, okay, let's sit down and go through it. And I didn't really have that with Escaping the Build Trap. I had friends I would call, but they weren't like in it with me, right? It wasn't like they were going to dedicate a bunch of time to actually figuring it out. So to me, that was the best part about writing with Denise, is that we could go back and forth and make sure that it sounded right to somebody else. We could brainstorm on topics. You know, we both tackled writing. I think Denise has a really great skill of like getting things down on paper, and she'd go out and she'd interview people for all the case studies we'd had in the book too. And then I could go through and like weave stories back into it or you know, create the fictional story that we did. So we traded off, you know, back and forth pretty well through the book. And I felt like it was a really good team effort. So I'm a huge fan of writing with a co-author. I didn't know if I would like it. Like, I like doing things by myself, honestly. And I will say that I highly recommend writing with a co-author.
Aww, that's nice. That's nice.
And how is it writing, Denise, with an experienced author who's recovering from writing her previous book?
Right. Well, I was just kind of amazed she said yes, because I came to her in 2021. And I'm like, I'm thinking of writing this book. Is that Banana Pants? And she's like, no, it's a great idea. And I said, why didn't you co-author it with me? And you hesitated a little bit, but not as much as I thought you would. But it's funny. I was chatting with a friend the other night and he's like, so when's your next book coming out? And I was like, never.
They always say that.
I'm good.
They always say that. Everybody goes, as soon as you write one, they're like, when's the next one coming out? And you're like, do you realize that I just spent the last 2.5 years of my life focused on this thing, trying to get it out? Like, give me a break. Just give me a moment.
Yeah. I think my response was, fuck no, I'm done. I'm good.
See, I said that until you asked me. That's the thing. It's like, you got to give it like 3 years, 4 years.
Childbirth.
I think it was 4 years. And then you forget about it. And then you start again and you remember why you didn't do it again right after.
Yeah. But it was amazing. Yeah. The 2.5 years we did it, we saw each other once in person. The rest of it was just Zoom calls and, you know, asynchronous stuff.
Yeah. But we'd seen each other a lot in person because we worked together before that. So for a couple of years.
So you had the relationship. It wasn't like you kind of met on speed dating and started writing a book. Like, you actually had the back and forth before that. You kind of knew how each other's rhythms and how you jive and stuff like that.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was going to say, Denise and I worked together like for years, consulting through Products Lab. So we'd seen each other in New York pretty much for 3 years straight. And then we were remote because COVID, and then we just kept going. So it was a lot easier because of that. And also we had done this work together through consulting. So when we were, working together, we went and implemented product operations at all these companies together. So a lot of our philosophies I knew it was going to be similar. Like, we weren't going to have wildly differing opinions, but there were certain places where I thought it was nice because we would clash on a couple different things and Denise would bring like a new perspective. And since we, stopped consulting together, Denise is doing a lot of work on her own, finding new perspectives. I'm doing a lot of work on my own here. So we're able to like marry those things together now after working together for so long.
I do have to ask though, and I always like to ask this when there's more than one author on a book, is you talked a little bit about clashes. Like, what was the biggest disagreement or argument that you had about the book? Like, the thing that took the longest to resolve, or was it all fairly small stuff that you kind of just glossed over pretty quickly? Like, was there like a big sticking point, or was it all quite harmonious?
I don't remember one. Do you?
I don't remember one either.
It was just like, I remember like it was keep the lights on or keep lights on. So it was like little things like that.
KTLO KLO. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
nothing crazy.
It was just silly things like that.
Yeah. And it would be like what terminology we would want to use on certain things. And that was basically it. But it was all stuff we could resolve in an hour.
But it's good. These are good perspectives to kind of bring to bear. And like, how is it said? What should we do? Nothing earth shattering.
Absolutely. Well, disagree and commit on the little stuff and don't sweat the big stuff, because it was all okay. But the result of that was a book. And for the uninitiated, maybe people who live under a rock, or they're just getting into this sort of thing, or they've just never thought about this sort of thing before, what's the core value proposition of the book? And for that matter, who really should be picking it up and reading it?
So the core proposition of product operations is that, I'll tell you how I got into product operations and why I saw this actually become a thing. And that's what spurred us trying to write this book. When I was leading the transformation at Athena Health, we had about 5,000 people across the organization in product and tech. We had over 350 product managers. And when I went in, we trained all the product managers, we started doing a good strategy work, and there was still this gap. It was like, hey, people now have the skills, we're deploying good strategy, but what about the things of how we find an operating cadence when it comes to getting good data in to inform strategy in a systematic way? And then also figuring out how to go back and revisit strategy and figure out how we work together as teams. And it was beyond just simple processes that we all know about Scrum. It was more like, how do we level this up throughout the whole product organization? And what do we do to bring all those things together? And there was this gap. And when we looked at it, it was very operation centric, right? It's about how we work together. It's about how we actually find a cadence for making informed decisions and then revisit those decisions and then make sure we're going in the right way. So that's really what product operations is about. It's about removing the barriers to creating and deploying great strategy and then revisiting that strategy and making sure that it's still up to par. And then also how we work together as a product organization with those surrounding functions and with each other.
Yeah. And if you just had to boil it down to one sentence, the way I like to think about it is making sure that product managers are able to make faster and better quality decisions, whatever strategy, prioritization, thinking about how they work.
Now, that makes sense to me, and we'll dig into what some of that means in a minute. But I did want to call out, and you just touched on it, Minister, just now, the kind of the business fable aspect of this as well. Now, I love a good business fable. You've got things like Radical Focus, you've got the Phoenix Project, you've got Five Dysfunctions of a Team, you've got all of the different ones, and now obviously you've got this one as well. And you went down this route with your fictional company, Pipeline 3K, their new CPO, Ashley, who's come in from somewhere else and is struggling to make sense of any of it and didn't really get what was maybe written on the tin when she went for the interview process. Even she sort of turned up at somewhere that's just completely different to what she expected, and she doesn't know where to get started. Now, I'm not going to sit there and say that I'm not aware of many companies that could be considered a bit like that. And I'm sure we've all worked for some of them, and everyone listening to this has probably been in those sorts of situations. But where did the idea, first of all, to make it a business fable come into it? And also, how easy was it to make that dysfunctional company without effectively naming and shaming or implicitly naming and shaming people that you've worked with?
So I wrote also a fable of Marketly in Escaping the Bill Trap. And I did that because I had written a rough draft of Escaping the Bill Trap. And what O'Reilly does is they send it out to a bunch of like first reviewers. And those reviewers come back and write about 10,000 comments line by line in a Word document, which is extremely overwhelming from 20 people about what they understand, what they don't understand, what they agree with, blah, 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 blah. And it's all people who know product management. And as I was sifting through that, at first I opened that book and I was like, oh my God, I can't possibly read all these comments. Like, I'm never going to write a book again. And then I started to digest them and I realized that there was a thread missing throughout the book. And that's when I went back and wrote about Marketly. So I ended up rewriting Escaping the Bill Trap in like the 2 months before it was due to be published, wove in the entire Marketly story. And then afterwards I was like, okay, now there's a thread, right? Now there's something to follow. Now you can relate it back to real life. It's not just like a jumble of stories on it. And I found like it was easier to follow and it was easy to, you know, compare your companies with Marketly. But that was a whole, it's funny because everybody I worked with before Escaping the Bill Trap, they were like, oh, I know who this person is in our company, right? Like one of my clients would be like, oh, I know who this person is. And I'm like, it's not just that person though. It's also five other people from my five other companies. Like there is one of, you know, there's a John or whoever at every single company. But it's funny because people feel like you're like, oh, this is a story about me, but it's not, because we see these patterns over and over and over again in all the dozens to hundreds of companies that I've worked with. So when we started writing Product Operations, I told Denise from the start, I was like, I think we need a fictional company, because to me, that really helped people with Escaping the Bill Trap just follow what the journey was and see it evolve. So that's how we started to think about Pipeline 3K and what we were going to do there, and started to create all the characters. I will say it's probably a lot harder to write a book that way, because you do have to create this entire backstory, right? You have to make up a company. And to me, that's super challenging. I do that in my school as well at Product Institute, where we're like trying to create fictional companies that you could follow through it. But it's a lot of work to make up a company and then try to like find relevant numbers, put it all together, all of that stuff. But I do
that
think
was it probably
makes
more work than it was, some of the other bits. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As we wanted to write the book, it was important to me. So Melissa's like, a fictitious company really helps tie it together. And that was a way to sort of make a composite of all of the good and anti-patterns we'd seen. But also, it was important to me that we include really practical and real life information. So it's almost like three layers. So you've got the fictitional company, you've got the sort of core content of what Product Operations is. And then I really wanted to include case studies from real practitioners, things that went well, things that didn't go well. And people were really open about sharing that. So we were able to speak to a number of practitioners. So Athena Health, someone who started Product Ops at Uber and Stripe, he's now at OpenAI, Blake Samick, and Fidelity, Amplitude. So that was important to have just sort of the different layers to give a different perspective.
Yeah. I love the perspective of having case studies, I will say too, in this book. I was really excited about that. In Escaping the Bill Trap, I tried to go get case studies, but nobody wants to talk about how they were screwing things up. So it's like much harder to do it on a book like that. But everybody was so willing to talk about it with this book, which was awesome. I was just really proud of the community.
I think it's a really interesting point, though, this whole thing. And this is something that I struggle with a little bit. Like if I give a webinar or the training thing that I was doing, is like, your point, Melissa, is very valid. Like people definitely don't want to be used as bad examples, right? So you go into somewhere and you're like, someone's like, yeah, you tell someone to do something like, yeah, do this with the sales team or do that with the sales team. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, have you got an example of that? And you're like, oh, yeah, well, old Dave that I used to work with. Oh, no, I can't say that, can I? Because blah, blah, blah. So, like, you end up almost having to fluff it and sound theoretical, or, like you say, making it up. But it does. I tried to make one up, for an example. It was an incredible amount of work, and everything just felt inauthentic because it wasn't, you know, it obviously was inauthentic. It wasn't real. It had elements of different things that I'd pulled from other places, but it just didn't feel real. So, I don't know. Have you got any tips for people that maybe are trying to do that sort of thing to maybe not violate NDAs, that they can maybe try and make it feel like a real thing? Like, how much time would you say it took you to create a realistic Pipeline 3K company?
Oh, it took us a long time. I think it's valid though. Like, you, if you're going to use it for teaching materials or examples like that, the thing is you want to make one example and then keep going with it. And that's the hard part. I struggle with this a lot because a lot of the engagements that I've had with companies are under NDA. So I can't go tell you about, you know, what this Fortune 10 company is doing or what this Fortune 10 company is struggling with. But I do tell people, I'm like, everybody struggles with this. But then they're like, well, give me a very specific example of how, like, this company does it. And if it's something good and it's something well-known that you could go research and it's not violating NDA, I will go do that. Or what I've done as well is try to invite the leaders onto a podcast or something like that to tell the story. And that's nice because then I could take it and then I'm like, oh, they said it in their words. Their legal team checked it. You know, now I can put it out there on, well, on what's going on. Hopefully, you know, most, any big Fortune 10 company, I've had to do that. Like, we have to go through the whole legal process. But even Fidelity, we went through the whole legal process to get their case study in there. So they checked it. They made sure they were cool with it. But I'd say if you can't do that, it's, I try to be like, a SaaS company that's around $20 million and worked in a platform business does X, Y, and Z. So I'll be more generic about it, but it's hard because I've also worked with a ton of these big names and I would love to go tell people, you know, what they're doing, but I can't. So I'm not going to violate those NDAs, but I hope that they're willing to go out on the record and start to share some of their stories. Cause, you know, over the years that I've been doing this too, I've seen so many good turnaround stories and I've seen so much more progress in some of these companies. And I really wish their legal teams would let them tell those stories. Cause I think it would attract a lot more talent and it would help people learn.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting point, and you raised it a little bit ago as well around this idea that everyone thinks that you're talking about them when you're giving an example, right? And like, I've definitely had, you know, I've put stuff up on LinkedIn in the past about, you know, such and such a thing, and you get kind of pulled up afterwards. Oh, you can't say that sort of thing. So I wasn't saying that about you. Like, that's literally what every single team that you're in does in all companies. So, you know, but everyone thinks that they're the only company that has the problems. So. Yep. I guess it's just one of those interesting things that you have to cater for when you're creating content, I guess.
Yeah, everybody thinks they're a special snowflake. And I tell them all, you're not all special snowflakes. they're all special snowflakes. That's at least what we say. But a lot of the problems that people are dealing with in product management are similar. And I think we all have to recognize that, is that we're not alone out there. I've had a lot of companies be like, well, you won't quite get this because, you know, we're in a certain situation here. And I'm like, well, so was this competitor that I worked with, you know, 5 years ago, same spot. But we're all on this journey together. And I think there's a lot of companies, even like really big name SaaS companies are doing that. That's another thing that I get all the time that I'm curious how you guys deal with too, or what you've seen, Denise. I'll have people, when I come in to work with organizations, they go, well, describe to me an entire organization that does this really well, top to bottom. Like, can you give me like 10 organizations that do product management super well? And I have a really hard time doing that. I can tell them product leaders, I think, who are great product leaders that I would go follow. I can give them 10 of those easily. But every organization has its challenges. And even the ones that we think are darling places to be a product management person at, they have their challenges too. And it's been very hard to find one company or a singular company where everything's running extremely smoothly. And even the ones that are highly successful, like, you know, top of the stock market or putting out products that everybody talks about on Twitter and everybody's really excited about, even they have their challenges, right? It doesn't necessarily mean they're following a template top to bottom there. They found a great product that people want. And it's about solving problems at the end of the day, right? That's what product management is about. It doesn't necessarily mean that they operate in a super crisp, clean way, but it works for them. And I think we just all have to acknowledge that that's going to be the case and not get on high horses about, you know, you must do this super specifically, or, you know, I want a company that looks exactly like this that you describe. It's about first principles and then adopting your first principles and figuring out what that means for us and what's going to work in our environment.
Yeah, I think that's really valid about the principles, and also just the difficulty of using anyone as an example. Probably just go to ChatGPT in that sort of situation and just get that to tell me some stuff and just send it to them. Hope they don't ask again. But it is an interesting kind of subtext there, is that there are basically no best practices, just best principles. Would you agree with that?
Half and half. So I believe that there are principles that we should embody. I do believe there are some best practices out there. But what I do firmly believe is that practices lead to behavior, and that behavior leads to your culture. And if you are doing practices that are not good, let's say awful practices, not best practices, right? You could create a culture that's not great. So I think there is a difference between, you know, practices, principles, behavior, culture, all those different things. But as long as the practices, I think, lead to behavior change that is good for a company and embodies those principles and then gets to the values that you're looking to create, then that works.
It's like doing your karate moves and stuff. I know you've got your product kata as well, but like doing your karate moves and using them to practice the moves, and then hopefully you build the muscle memory. So it's all about building that muscle memory.
Exactly.
But let's zoom out a bit and talk a little bit more about product operations. Yeah, we talked a little bit about what product operations is, and I think you describe it in the book as the discipline of helping your product management function scale well. So based on that definition, when's really the right time to start thinking about a product operations function? I mean, when you're mentioning at scale, it kind of seems to imply that as the company gets to a certain size or number of products or portfolio size or something like that. But I also seem to remember in the book that you said something along the lines of, it's not really just about size. There could be other factors that maybe get you along that path. So what are some of the signals that you're reaching an inflection point that it might be about time to start thinking about setting something like this up?
I think there's we give an example in the book from Blake Samick, and talking about how at Uber, there were certainly signals that it was time. They were scaling a lot, going into different territories and geographies. And sort of collaboration practices were really starting to fray at the edges. And sales didn't know what was happening with the product. Product wasn't necessarily connected with customers were saying. So things were just kind of starting to crumble. Luckily, they caught that and thought about, what do we need to do to put just enough support and enablement around this to try to bring this back together and make sure we've sort of bringing forward what worked for us up to this point. So I think it's when a miscommunication, a lack of visibility and transparency, and especially as you go from one product to a portfolio, that tends to sort of start pushing things as well.
But it's interesting, because if you go all team topologies on your ass, then it starts to become like more like yeah, every single team should be like its own independent thing. There should be everything very well sort of structured and minimal handoffs and, you know, a few external interfaces between teams, and they can kind of take care of business a lot or quite a lot within their own units. And that kind of flies a bit against this idea that as you scale, you need to start to introduce other ways of managing that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in this agile world, in this team topologies world, we should all be kind of self-contained units, right? Like, do you think that works in a scaled organization?
We should and we could, but in a lot of cases, it's not happening, right? So it's the theoretical, but in practicality, it's not. And so when you can sort of come clean and say, this isn't working, what do we need to do to get our arms around this? That's where product operations comes in.
I was going to say, I met Matthew at a conference last month in London too, and we've talked about sitting down and going through this with team topologies and product ops. He was telling me, we were talking a little bit about it. We didn't get in deep, so I'm going to leave that for when we actually discuss it, because I won't claim to have unpacked it with him by any means. I think the big thing here, though, is that when we talk about product operations as a function, we're not suggesting you hire a one-to-one interface type thing between product managers and the rest of the organization. We're saying, think of it almost as like internal tools, right? Don't you want a SWAT? Like, we build internal tools for developers all the time. There's DevOps. Why can't there be product ops, right? We have sales ops teams. Now everybody's like upset about the product ops team, but I've never heard anybody say that DevOps is useless.
But that's a really fascinating point, because I was thinking about this a little while back when I was looking at a company that did have a sales operations team, wasn't necessarily being as effective as it could be. And you're sitting there thinking, well, obviously we need sales ops. Like, that's just the thing that companies have as they start to scale their sales organization. So what's the difference? Because like no one's sitting there telling the salespeople that they need to be the ones that start instrumenting Salesforce or all of those things, right? Like I don't believe those conversations happen. So why do you think it is the case then that people are arguing against, say, product operations versus sales operations or research operations or marketing operations, all these other types of operations that seem to be just fine to have and everyone kind of agrees that they're valuable. But product operations is the one that doesn't get that.
Two words. Agile coaches.
There you go.
That's why everybody's arguing about it. Because there are people out there who are claiming to be product ops people and they're just former agile coaches who are looking for a new label because people are getting rid of agile coaches. Just because somebody isn't doing product operations correctly doesn't mean the whole function's bad.
Yeah. And I think there's also the idea that that some people have espoused, which is basically that product operations is almost like the revenge of the product of the PMO. Like yeah. It's the almost yeah. like this idea that as companies have tried to transform, that they've got to this point where you've got all these former project managers or program managers that are sort of sitting there with nothing to do anymore. And rather than them leaving or finding something else to do within that organization, they kind of just retask them as process people for product people.
Yep.
Have you seen that a lot? And do you think it works?
I mean, certainly I've seen it a lot. I don't know that we could say wholesale. No, it does not work. I think it depends on the skill set of these folks. Another area I see this happening a lot is agile coaches deciding to be product coaches. So it's happening in a couple of ways. So I also think that maybe folks are having a challenge with the concept of product operations. It's new. And I think we have sort of built out this fantasy product manager who has eight arms and who can do everything. And if they're not able to do that, we don't have the right people is possibly the thought process there. So I think it's about getting real and understanding that, you know, having a product manager writing a SQL script off the side of their desk doesn't make them a better product manager. They are gold at the end of the year on revenue growth, product engagement, not how many SQL scripts they wrote because business insights were not able to provide something in a systemic way for the product managers.
The negative feedback we seem to get comes from a couple camps. One, product influencers who just want to create a stir on LinkedIn.
Yes.
Never happens.
Never happens, right? Like, so I have seen a ton of, I see the posts, I get tagged in them. And I don't engage because I'm like, also, I'll go look at this product influencer with a couple hundred thousand people. And I'm like, wow, you worked at one company. All right. And you've never consulted with the hundreds of companies that we have. So what do you have to compare it to, right? It's just your opinion at that point. That's where a lot of the feedback comes from. I also see it come from product managers. When it comes from product managers, they're like, oh, well, if you have product ops people doing all this data stuff and things like that, then what am I supposed to do? And I'm like, what the hell are you doing, right? If you are only going out there and digging through SQL queries to get data, like it's fine that you know SQL and you can pull the data yourself, but should you have to? Right? You should be out there collaborating, creating models, trying to figure out, is this the right thing to do? Talking to your customers, right? Like solving problems, testing, creating hypotheses, creating experiments, working with your developers, working with your designers to find something good. So if you're going to spend all of your time doing the grunt work, and then you're afraid that your grunt work goes around, I think you're just fearful that people are going to catch you not doing great product management. So that's the other ones that I kind of see come up. But most product managers, I say the majority of people we've worked with, like the CPO of Athena Health said he'll never work anywhere else that doesn't have a product operations team, right? He refuses to go anywhere without it now that he's seen the value. He was skeptical at first. And, you know, Tim came in, did a great job, showed him the value. And he's like, this changed my life. And the leaders that I know who do product operations well or hired a great person to do it, they say the same thing. They're like, this changed my life. Same with the product managers who get to work with those teams. It's in practice, I think when it's done well, people see the impact of it. But it's just new, as Denise was saying. So there's a lot of people out there trying to claim it and grab it for themselves so that they don't end up without a job or they can rebrand themselves. And it doesn't necessarily mean they're doing it well.
So in the book, let's talk a little bit about what these people are actually doing then, the product ops people, when you do spin up the team. So you call out in the book three core pillars of product ops. Now, I love a pillar diagram as much as the next person, so I'm really glad to see some pillars. Need to find a little hat on top, product operations. I don't know what the base is. But what are the three pillars of product operations and why are they so important? And why do we need team or a team to look at them specifically?
Well, it's interesting. We have the three pillars And it's not a hard and fast structure. It's a way to think about how you might want to organize enablement around the product manager. So the first one is business and data insights. So the quantitative product engagement revenue, especially when you can get it. The second is customer market insights. So the qualitative. And the third is, process, practices, operating models. So how are we doing the work and how many cycles are we spending talking about doing the work rather than doing the work? So companies that I consult with, some are really leaning in heavily towards the first pillar of quantitative and, you know, maybe not adding in the process and practices piece because it's not important at that company. They already have that nailed down. Others are really all in on process and practices. Quantitative and qualitative are flowing well. But we see at a lot of companies that there are challenges within these three. And it's not about creating the quantitative. It's not about creating the qualitative. Probably those things exist at those companies, but they're not being, you know, understood and unlocked. So this is where product operations comes in. Being able to sort of understand how to harness that with a product lens and make sure the product team has access and knows how to use it.
But one could argue, and I'm going to, that those three things are all very important and absolutely should be done and probably aren't always done very well, or as you say, kind of disconnected and disparate. And mm-hmm. You know, we've all seen that, right? But also that they're quite different things in many ways. They might require different skills within the organization to, for example, be a good data analyst or be a good product processes person or be a good customer research organizer or customer research advocate or however that role goes. But when you're getting started with a product ops team, are you then really looking to get like some kind of all-rounder in to kind of just look after everything? Or are you very much recommending, you're both shaking your head, so I'm assuming that you're going to say no, but finish my question is like, are you really looking for someone to come in and kind of work on the most important thing? I think that's what you're saying, but is that really then what you're looking at? Get the most important pillar in first and then work out if you need the rest.
Exactly. We mentioned that in the book. We don't advocate trying to take on all of that at once. It's sort of boiling the ocean, spreading yourself too thin. So where's the biggest gap? Where's the biggest opportunity? And I teach a masterclass for products labs about, you know, sort of intro to product ops. And we do an interactive exercise where we set up product operations. This right now is at OpenAI. Practice. And people, it's like, do you want to hire for a data analyst or for a process person? I give them a scenario. I'm like, well, can we just hire for both? And I'm like, that's a purple squirrel. If you could find someone like that, amazing, but you're not going to be able to for the purposes of this. So pick one. So it's really about where the biggest needs and opportunities are.
I'll also say too, in some organizations, we do acknowledge in the book as well, there are other functions that could be doing the data side or could be doing the user research side. And we don't advocate for if they're being done well to just like replace them and be like, they're product ops now. Like we say, work with those teams, but in so many organizations, those are big gaps. So if you are, so I'll give you an example. Doodle has a fantastic data science team and they already enable the entire product team to pull out whatever information they need. They bring them insights. They are getting them all the information from sales. They're doing all the things that we talk about in the data and insights piece. And they roll up to a chief data officer. And we're like, that's fine. Great. Great functional relationship. They have no problems with that. That's not any of their issues. Don't touch it, right? Like don't fix it if it's not broken. So what we are trying to do though is advocate for those companies where there is no scope on it. Or what I see more often than not is they do have a data science team, but the data science team is like, nope, we're paired with other people. We're paired with the engineers. We're paired with these other functions. We don't have time for product or we don't want to do this. We are suggesting that if that is the case and you can't get the information you need to make strategic decisions, that consider bringing those people onto your team under product operations so that you can make those decisions. Because the most important thing you can do in a company is make strategic decisions, right? And make the right strategic decisions. So if you just leave that up to, oh, well, we do have data people, but I can't get in touch with them, how is that benefiting anybody?
Right. One company I was working with, they said, well, once we have the reorg, we'll be good. I'm like, I don't know. It sounds like kind of a cultural thing. So massive, massive, massive financial company. They had a business and data insights group, but they were sort of supporting up the chain and not down the chain. And so to get any data at all, you had to submit a ticket and that it would take several weeks. And then you get the data. And by the time you got the data, it was outdated. So it's like, can we pull back? What does it look like to get folks set up where they have self-serve access to this data, but it just kind of keeps continuing this broken fashion. So that's where product operations can make a huge difference.
And in that example, I want to be like practical about it too. Like you may hire a product operations data analyst person, right? Maybe they go liaison with that data science team and they advocate for getting the system set up so that you can pull your own queries, so that you do get your own dashboards. Maybe they're making the dashboards for the product team. Maybe they're creating the views for leadership to be able to inform good strategic product decisions. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to hire an entire like data science team yourself if there is a data science team, but at least you have somebody there whose job it is to set up that for the product team. And they can go utilize the tools and the things that they already have in the company to get that done.
And it also saves, I think, your business and data insights team. What if we said, okay, 48 product managers, you now have to get data from this team, and they're all hitting this team hard, asking for their disparate needs, right? So the idea is get this set up systemically. And once that's done, if you have a data analyst, they move on to higher value work, right? Advising, partnering with them. And that was my experience with product operations on the operating side when I led a product team at a B2B SaaS called Cision. These folks were partners with us. They understood the product. They understood the data. But the sort of secret sauce was that they had a certain remove, a little more objectivity because we were too close to the data. And they could make recommendations, advise, see, this might be a problem here. This could be an opportunity. What if we did this type of test? So once you get the sort of table stakes, that's where it gets really interesting in the partnership.
All right. But one of the objections that we get then, and we've talked about it a little bit already, is this idea of like process people, the people that are just sort of people that are almost watching the people do the work to some extent. And I know that that's kind of a simplification, but like that's one of the criticisms that people have. Like, we just got these people kind of just making the work happen, but not doing the work. And you talk in the book about how product operations is a cost center. And of course it is, like a lot of things within an organization that's building stuff. So I think it's fair to say these days that people don't 100% love cost centers, and you know, everyone wants to save as much money as they can. So there needs to be some kind of return on investment. People need to see the benefit. So what are some of the kind of key inflection points, or how long it might take, for example, for a penny-pinching CFO to start to see some actual benefits, some value, and some return on investment on a product operations function?
It really depends on sort of where you are in that state. So the thing is, so I spoke last month at PLA's Product Operations Summit here in New York, and my talk was about leaner times, why product operations is more important than ever. And what kind of got me motivated for this talk was Daniel Ek of Spotify, his infamous memo from December. And there was a little point in there. He said, you know, we're spending too much time doing the work around the work. And I was like, he means product ops. Yep. And thinking about, you know, why this? And then sort of chatting with Melissa about it. We're like this sort of mix up with agile coaches. How do we sort of stand out to create that value? There's a number of ways, right? So let's say, and we know he has removed people that do work around the work. Are the product managers building the right things? Are they building to build? Are we seeing more revenue? So I just saw a piece in Forbes from this week that he said, well, gosh, after that layoff, we're seeing some operational challenges. So let me look here. So the challenge was they were able to get to their profits, but they didn't hit their guidance on profitability and monthly active user growth. So I would say that's a sign.
Yeah. I think everybody tries to strip out a lot of those things that, you know, make teams run well. And I'm not suggesting that we should have a large team for it. Even in the book, we're like product operations. People do go back to the org chart we put in there and they're like, this is massive. And you have to remember, like, it's a big part of the org chart that we have in the book. I'm talking like JP Morgan size companies. Like most companies don't have 100,000 employees.
But when
you have 100,000 employees with like 18 product divisions across the company that all roll up to a C-level, like, yeah, your product operations function could be bigger. Like it could scale with that. But we're not talking about that kind of team for a 500 or even a 5,000 person company, right? That's not the case. So we do believe, though, in this case, you should be scaling well. And the more I've gotten into this and the more I've talked to people, I do really firmly believe in what we describe as like a shared services model, where you're trying to have like the product managers for product managers, but some companies aren't there yet. They can't do the whole shared services model. So in the meantime, you might have to have a couple embedded people to help the teams actually get things going, get the data they need or get the insights they need, where we align people back to them. And a lot of companies have those models as well. But I think when you're talking about like ROI and seeing this, it goes back to what we talked about with what the purpose of product operations is. It's removing the barriers to make strategic decisions. It's going to directly impact how fast you can realize your goals. So is that going to be in a month, right? How long does it take you to actually see annual recurring revenue go up for any company, right? It's going to take a while, right? But you have to trust it. You have to invest in it. You have to iterate on it, just like anything else. You're not going to hire a developer and be like, hey, that developer, who we also see as cost centers a lot of the time, which I don't agree with.
Right.
You know, they go, oh, that developer, like, can you produce ROI for me in like 1 month? It's probably not going to happen unless you're a tiny startup that's just, you know, just starting to put things out to people.
Oh, fair enough. And I'm obviously always in favor of people being seen as the value creators that they are. And also, I think it's about, for me, looking for signals, like with anything, right? Like you say, with ARR and everything else, like leading indicators rather than lagging indicators that something's starting to happen, and trying to work out what that something's going to look like. And I think an interesting thing that you say in the book as well is that, you know, there's always going to be process within an organization anyway, right? And one of the things that I like most about your definition of product operations is almost making sure that process isn't kind of revisited, or that people aren't reinventing the wheel, as well as that you're not actually putting too much process in by mistake, and you've actually got people that are making sure that you're being efficient, not just layering process on for the sake of it.
Yeah. And I think, like, because of agile, people think process is a dirty word, and it's not. Like, how do you operate if you don't have a process? Right? Like, we're not all going out there willy-nilly and just being like, this sounds good, I guess I'll build it, right? Like, that's not how businesses work. So
that's how some businesses work.
That is actually how a lot of businesses work, and it's not good. It's why we still have jobs. But I do think there's this like gut reaction of like, oh my God, you said process. Like, it's about people over processes. And like, sure, I agree with that. But even if you go back to the Agile Manifesto, it's like people over processes. They didn't say screw processes, right? They said, maybe we should worry more about that. And I believe that that's firm when it comes to principles as well, and values and how we do things. But you do need process to work. That's what any company needs.
I think it's the same as the argument about strategy. Like, even if you don't have an actual strategy, you have a kind of implicit strategy. Yep. That's just the sum of all the decisions that you've made. And I guess it's the same with process as well, right? Like, there is an operating model that you're operating under.
Right.
It just might not be a very good one. All right. So actionable takeaway time. I always like to get actionable in situations like this and make sure that we're not just seen as people that are just sort of high on our own supply.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, there's enough of that in the world. So if there's some product leader out there or CEO listening to this thinking, well, that all sounds great, but where on earth do I get started? Now, obviously, they could just read your book, but in principle, what's one first concrete step that they should take on the path to product operations nirvana?
Yeah, I think it's just sort of recognizing your current state, right? And having sort of a clear-eyed view of what's working and what isn't. And that is the first step, and being really honest with yourself that, do my product managers have everything they need to set strategy, prioritize, work well with cross-functional stakeholders? If not, where's the biggest sort of pain point? What are we hearing from our stakeholders too? Like, do your roadmaps look like, you know, Mad Lib guesses, right? So that might be a place to start. So it's really about figuring out where the biggest pain points are. And you don't have to buy the book. It'd be great if you did, but there's lots of good content, lots of good influencers out there to understand what it's about. And it's still nascent enough of a function that you might be able to hire somebody, but oftentimes you may have someone great in your team who's really excited about systems thinking. And that's where we see a lot of successful folks migrating over that had been product managers. They have the empathy and understand sort of what product is, but get really excited about smoothing things out to make sure the product managers are focusing on the right things.
But do you think that's something that they can do themselves if they've got no experience in this area at all? Or is this something where they're either going to have to hire someone to do it and start to do some of those things themselves, or get a consultant in to kind of almost boot the effort up and then they can decide what to do after that? Like, because it's hard to know what you don't know, right?
Exactly. It can be either way. You can sort of think about that sort of highest need initially and think like, could I devote a quarter of somebody's bandwidth right now that's on the team? And let's sort of do this as a proof of concept and start small and understand if we can get a win there. But there's no right way. I'd hate to say like, you must read the book, you must hire a consultant. It's really about figuring out what works for you. So that would be my suggestion. And if you did want to take this on yourself, you could read the book. We've got at the end of each section, we've got sort of three things to do today to get started. So to try to get things jump started for folks. Again, that was my bugaboo about other product books, that it's just like, here's the nirvana, bye, good luck. So we want, like, how do you get there? Paint the path.
That all sounds amazing. I'm sure that'll inspire a few people to come up and do some things. But where can people find both of you after this if they want to keep up with your content, chat to you about product ops, or get some tips on how to harmoniously write a category-defining book together?
That's a great question. We have productoperations.com, and we are adding more content to that folks can access for free. I'm at denisetillis.com. Melissa, where can folks find you?
You can find my online school at productinstitute.com. And then if you want to reach out and contact me, you could go to melissaperry.com, and there's a lot of information there too. And you can buy our book at Amazon, or other places are listed at productoperations.com.
Wherever you buy your books, just like podcasts. All right. Well, I'll make sure to link that all into the show notes, and hopefully get a few more people picking it up and having a look through all the nice little diagrams and trying to work out how to apply it to their context. Well, as expected, that's been a fabulous chat about all things product operations. So big thanks for sparing the time. Wish you both continued success of the book. Obviously, we'll keep in touch. But yeah, as for now, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As always, thanks for listening, or indeed watching. I hope you found the episode inspiring and insightful. If you did, again, I can only encourage you to hop over to onenightinproduct.com, check out some of my other fantastic guests, sign up to the newsletter, subscribe on your favourite podcast app or YouTube, and make sure you share with your friends so that you and they can never miss another episode again. I'll be back soon with another inspirational episode, but as for now, thanks and good night.